Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is December 3rd. We have Luke Roman, Ira Harris, and Judd Hirschberg. Luke founded FFTT in early 2014. FFTT caters to institutions and sophisticated individuals by aggregating a wide variety of macroeconomic, thematic, and sector trends in an unconventional manner to identify investable developing economic bottlenecks for his clients. And Ira is independent trader, past hedge fund manager, and global macro consultant trading foreign currencies, equities, bonds, and commodities for over 40 years. He was also CME director from 1997 to 2003, and also recently in 2019. We also have today chief investment strategist Judd Hirschberg of White Wave Trading Strategies to help form the basis of some of the discussion with his charts and technical analysis indicators. Welcome, gentlemen.
Thanks for having me back on.
This is a phenomenally great pleasure because he is the biggest star probably right now in global macro. And I say that with great respect.
I appreciate that. That's it's extremely humbling coming from you. Thank you.
Don't be so humble. Trust me. Well, hold on. Let me go get my wife. She'll straighten you out right away.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Let's begin, Luke, with your global macro view on the economy and the financial markets.
On the markets in particular, I'm about as bearish as I've been in probably since April of 2022, maybe. And that's a reversal just in the last 3 weeks. I really had been watching, obviously, different tightening. I've been getting more fundamentally concerned, but ultimately was of the view that we were seeing policymakers move towards, you know, some of the stopgap solutions that they had set up, whether that be standing repo facility, whether that be the end of QT, whether that be rate cuts, et cetera. Even, you know, in the last week, this change to SLR exemptions, which was relatively modest, but still a marginal incremental addition to liquidity in theory. But in the last, really, I guess, in the last several weeks have come to the conclusion based on a number of different factors, and I'd been kind of building to this, but came to the firm conclusion that essentially anything less than nuclear level printing is tightening. So despite these marginal liquidity additions, they're, in my opinion, they're not going to be nearly enough. And so we're setting up, I think, for a very volatile first half of next year. And I've started thinking about the first half of next year in particular in sort of three discrete time horizons, sort of BC, year zero, and AD, or if you will, before nuclear printing, nuclear print, after nuclear printing. And so if you put a gun to my head, I'd say probably sometime in the second quarter, by the end of the second quarter, I think we'll get sort of that nuclear printing, both by virtue of a forcing factor of markets, but then also next year, we have a political constraint that we know about, which is midterms and the lead times before midterms. And so, you know, that's kind of my setup for the moment. So, like I said, I'm about as concerned and cautious as I bearish and cautious as I've been in nearly 4 years, because essentially what I'm seeing, anything less than nuclear printing is tightening.
Interesting comments. Your thoughts, Ira, on that?
Well, first of all, yes, I don't put in those terms, but those terms are absolutely right. And we saw it a couple of things. So I'm totally with Luke. I mean, I was just, my portfolio was my portfolio, and I was looking to continue down this path. But, you know, 10 days ago, I really thought we were going to be into a, or maybe 8 day trading day wise, where we were going to be into an absolute crisis, because we're starting to see deleveraging. Not only were the equity markets getting whacked, which they were, the metals were going down with them very aggressively. And of course, Bitcoin was pushing down to levels of, as Judd will put up, a major support down at that 79,000 to 81,000. And we were all going there at the same time. So they were moving that way. And I go, well, this is a major deleveraging event. And then, of course, on that Friday or Thursday, Friday, the market turned and saved itself. But I still thought it was very interesting to see that, because that was a introduction to what is coming at some point. Because the world, when I say the world, I'm talking about retail investors at all, truly don't understand how much leveraging has been placed into the world. And now that, you know, and Monday we saw a very interesting day also, because every one of the major sovereign debts, meaning the developed world sovereign debt, they were all up 8 basis points. 8 basis points. U.S. 10-year up 8 basis points. Japan up 8 basis points. Germany up. They were all in that camp, very synchronized, even as the S&P was making lows that day. They were holding up there. So again, and again, Bitcoin was, you know, which for some people is a tell. I'm not so sure about it yet. But we saw that the leverage and the metals were moving. And then, of course, they turned back around. But I am watching for these events of deleveraging, because it's going to be a wake-up call to those. And I don't care whether you're bullish NVIDIA, bearish NVIDIA. That's the amount of leveraging. And as Luke talks about with the liquidity issue and anything that's not this massive amount of liquidity providing is tightening. We are in that realm. And you had a little introduction to it. You know, markets, a lot of, then they came back and who was doing the buying. I'm not even going to worry about that because I don't care about it. But interestingly, that more people are getting on this. And you had a piece put out by Rosenzweig and Goering, and the title of it is The Move from Carry to Anti-Carry. Now, that's not something I expect to see from that group. I have great respect for them in their work on energy and raw materials. But for them to go into that camp, I find fascinating. Because again, let's go back to Yellen and Brainard, right? Not that long ago, but when Yellen was cajoling, and I'm using that word in its full meaning, Kuroda at the BOJ, not to raise rates, because in 21, 22, they were worried about a major global bond liquidation. So the Japanese held off. I don't know whether they would have done it anyway, but they were, but between Brainard and Yellen, they were pushing the Japanese hard not to raise rates. Now the Japanese are in a situation of their own making, because Kuroda has smaller testicles than the present prime minister, and where he should be raising rates, probably to 1 to 1.5%, and they're still negative, real yield is still negative, but it would go a long way to assuaging some of the people who are selling JGBs, because the JGBs are doing what the BOJ should be doing anyway, because we know those yields are up to 1.88 this morning. So the market's doing it. When is it going to have its moment? It's coming. And I think we saw that the last week in or the last 2 weeks in November, when we saw some of that deleveraging. I'll stop.
Okay. Can you elaborate a bit more, Luke, on these liquidity challenges? Are they emanating from the U.S. repo repurchase agreement markets, or something to do with Japan, from the liquidity sources?
Yes. Okay. All of the above. Okay. You know, what was getting my attention was, you know, we've written and talked a lot for a long time about the fiscal side in the U.S. to start. And we've been noticing that despite record stock market, record tax receipts, record tariffs The U.S. Fiscal deficit is not really coming down much. There is still a crowding out aspect going on. That's problematic. And the measure I spend the most time focused on is the interest and interest-like obligations of the U.S. government relative to their receipts. And even with record receipts and record tariffs, which might get overruled by the Supreme Court, we'll see. Let's just set that aside. But let's assume they continue. You have true interest expense, which we calculate as gross interest plus entitlement payments, plus Veterans Affairs. They're still right around 100% of receipts, despite record receipts and despite tariffs. That's a problem. That wasn't supposed to happen. And so that was number one, all else equal. When I'm seeing that and I'm not seeing a lot of liquidity alongside that, which we would see showing up as a falling dollar and rising Bitcoin and et cetera, that already sets my spidey sense, sets it off. So then we start to see the fallout of what has been essentially 30 straight months of Yellen and then Bessent shifting issuance to the front end. And they're starting to have a problem. What is known in the oil patch as a treadmill problem or as a Red Queen problem. They have to run faster and faster just to stay in the same spot, which is to say, in a great conversation with a Treasury funding analyst named John Comiskey about a month and a half ago, where we had noticed the Treasury General account, the TGA, which is just the Treasury's checking account, essentially rising and withdrawing liquidity. And I thought it might be related to the shutdown. I thought it might be Bessent playing 4D chess to basically try to force a liquidity problem and force the Fed in to begin doing something else. And Comiskey, to his credit, said, no. He said, this is entirely predictable. I've been calling for the TGA to rise to nearly $1 trillion for weeks. You can see it on my Substack. And I said, well, is it deficit related? And the fact they're shifting to the front end? He said, present deficits a little bit. He said the bigger issue is they've been doing it for so long now that they have to maintain a Treasury General account level that gives them sufficient cash cushion to manage the role of this Treasury. In 2013, Secretary of the Treasury Jack Lew testified to Congress. He was rolling about $100 billion a week in bills. It's up to nearly $550 billion a week in bills they're rolling. And so that requires a secularly higher Treasury General account. And it's gone from $100 billion to $550 billion because of higher deficits and also having to shift to the front end because there's insufficient demand at the long end at prices the U.S. can afford that won't touch off a risk-off, problem. So the TGA's got to go higher. That's fine. But now the TGA, once they've run down reverse repo, means the TGA is starting to tighten liquidity in the U.S. banking system. Reserves are coming down, which means you start to have dollar up. You start to have tighter liquidity. It starts showing up in these short-term funding markets. So then we start seeing funding strains. So that's funding strains was strike two for me, right? So I see the true interest expense, the receipts, strike one. Funding strains and overnight markets, strike two. You're seeing this standing repo facility being tapped like it hasn't been before. You're seeing SOFR over interest on excess reserves, interest on reserve balances starting to rise above sort of acceptable levels. Those are strike two. Then you layer on what I was talking about with the JGB market, which is, he's forgotten more about Japan and the JGB market than I'll ever know. From my tourist standpoint, to me, there's two big global funding carry trades. It's the dollar and it's the yen. And we saw empirically in summer 2024, anytime the yen gets too strong, we have a problem. Anytime the yen gets too weak, we have a problem. And we're seeing, maybe most troublingly of all, emerging market behavior in the JGB market, which is every day I come in, JGB yields are up, and every day I come in and the yen's down. And when your yields are rising fast and your currency's not responding, that just tells me yields are going to have to go higher faster until your currency responds. And that's strike three for me in terms of risk, those three. And then I layer on if I need strike four or strike five, we'd been watching the AI dynamic, which had been consuming a lot of capital, obviously, over the last couple of years in particular. The consumption of that capital, though, up until literally 3 months ago, was primarily out of retained earnings and cash earnings of these tech companies. And in just the last 3 months, they've started not just borrowing aggressively, but using very creative, being generous, creative vendor financing schemes in order to borrow money. And it's been laid out that between 25 and 28 in the Wall Street Journal, citing Morgan Stanley research, that the AI is going to need almost $3 trillion in capital just to be able to continue losing money. And last week, David Sacks, the AI crypto czar, came out and said, well, AI spending is now half of GDP growth. And if it starts to go backwards, we risk a recession. And if we have a recession, deficits are going to blow out, because they always do. So you're in this situation where I've already got my three strikes to risk off, which are, you know, the U.S. fiscal situation. It's stressing short-term funding markets in the U.S. And the JGB market. But now I've also got AI, which is like a snake eating its own tail, where it's crowding out the U.S. government and the JGB market ostensibly, and it's a thirst for capital. But if it doesn't do that, it's also going to start competing, because it's going to potentially – it's going to trigger at least a slowdown and possibly a recession. And we know that in recessions over the last 20 years in this country, deficits go up 600 to 800 basis points plus of GDP. Which means even more issuance into where we already don't have enough issue, or, you know, have enough demand at yields that make the math work. So when I look at these four things, I just go, you know, to Ira's point, I don't know how it's going to break, when it's going to break, but I know I have some semblance of the leverage in the system, and the leverage is such top to bottom, sovereign on down, that we're in a world where nothing can be going wrong. And I've got four really big things that are sort of already not just smoking, but on fire. And those are situations for me where, like, you know, Iris said, I don't care who's buying, like, same kind of thing. What's going to break? I don't care. It doesn't matter. But it's because with this much pressure, when it happens, it's going to be fast and it's going to be aggressive. And I guess the last thing I'd ask is, or I'd say is, to me, the straw that broke the camel's back, to me getting very negative, was watching Bitcoin. Because for me, Bitcoin is a you know, one of the last, if not the last, functioning smoke alarm of global liquidity. And I don't do a lot of technical stuff, but the few that I do is really long-term technicals, because it tends to be more kind of what we're trying to do. Big picture, big moves, big turns. And on multiple different long-term momentum indicators, Bitcoin broke down very forcefully in a way that suggests essentially that the cycle's over. I mean, Bitcoin has been very reliable on a four-year cycle. And most importantly, the way Bitcoin traded is it's telling you the first half of next year is going to be sloppy. So that's – I'll pause there. But those are sort of – you know, I strike four, strike five, you know, all in there is the reasons why I'm so cautious as we go into next year.
Meet the Cedar Owl. A new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
What do you make of those strikes, Ira? Do you see anything breaking? What's your thoughts on Japan? What will happen?
Well, I'm not sure what's going to happen in Japan. I have a good sense of what the Japanese ought to do, and I can't believe the world hasn't put more pressure on them, especially the Europeans, because I watched the crosses for what they mean. And when the Germans are busy complaining about, and you see the numbers, they're not just complaining, they're real numbers, how bad the German auto sector is performing. And it's just not the Chinese. Don't forget that the Germans compete head on in the global auto business, directly with the Japanese. You know, the Lexus was created to absolutely compete directly with Mercedes, and with a week with a yen at, you know, a euro yen, which is what they care about, up at, you know, 35, 36 year highs, the euro against yen. It's very telling for the Germans, especially. Everybody will say, well, the rest of the European Union, I had this discussion with somebody. They said, well, the European Union runs a surplus with Japan. That's superfluous to the discussion. It's who they compete with. And you saw it recently, too, when the Australians were looking to buy ships. They bought 11 ships. And who did they wind up making the deal with? Well, there were two competing forces: Mitsubishi Heavy Industries and ThyssenKrupp, and ThyssenKrupp Maritime. And the deal went to the Japanese. The Japanese can outprice the Europeans every which way, and especially with the Swiss. You're seeing with Swiss farmer sales, but we'll get into that discussion. So the Japanese have provided this massive amount of liquidity, and the world is plenty nervous that this ramps in. And again, if you don't think that this takes place in discussions, all you do is have to go look at who sits at the G30. The G30 bothers the hell out of me because they have way too much influence in a world in an unelected body and who sits there. So these discussions are very important. And Luke goes right down the line with them. And then you look at the curtailing of the liquidity in the U.S. markets, and rightfully so, as he talks about the reverse repo and everything else going on. You know, I'm fortunate to follow the work of Alexandra Harris at Bloomberg as a subscriber to Bloomberg Outside, so I watch that. And she's been right on top of it as much as anybody, and I'm proud to say for many reasons why I follow her, but being that she is my daughter, and I'm very, very proud of that. But the work has been unbelievable. And the fact that Luke goes right there, that is so critically important to everything that we're talking about. Now, I was a believer, and I don't know that Luke and I ever talked about this, that when Bessent came into office, that he would orchestrate a failed auction in order to slap everybody in the head really hard as to wake up as to how they got to confront us. Because I'm with Luke. We're looking at government debt, and it's not just a U.S. number anymore. It's a global situation, which is why I talked about what happened on Monday with the sovereign debt, except for one, Switzerland. Switzerland is, to me, the canary in the coal mine in many ways, because here's a country that should be, the Swiss franc should be the bastion or every bit as much as important as the Japanese for the carry trade, because the Swiss National Bank and the Swiss government wants a weaker Swiss franc. They just can't get it. And this morning, the inflation data came out and it was negative. And Swiss rates are at zero. And the 2-year is, where am I at here? The 2-year is actually, I think, negative, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, it is. The Swiss 2-year rates are negative 18 basis points. So this should be the epitome of a carry trade, a country that wants a weaker currency and interest rates that you can borrow phenomenally cheap. And yet those inflation numbers came out in Switzerland and the currency is up 0.5% today. The currency is. So it's so you go figure that and tell me. But I watched that very carefully because I think it's a big statement about where the world is at. And what the Swiss franc tells me is that we'll keep buying Swiss francs, even though it pays me zero. It's like gold. I'm not earning anything on it, but I'm willing to buy it and put my money there. Why? And the only outlier reason can be because the Swiss have a much better fiscal situation, much better. And that's why people are willing to lend to them at zero. And that's the real telltale of their pivotal importance in the global financial system.
I mean, speaking of government debt and treasuries, Luke, something you've talked about a lot is on the hope, the strategy of the U.S. U.S. Treasuries to put a bid on U.S. debt. What is the likelihood that this works? And I guess more importantly, will it be robust enough? Like, will it be scalable enough to meet the required levels?
Sorry, put a bid under Treasuries?
The U.S. dollar stablecoins.
Oh, gotcha. Yeah. Let me start with, I think, a supplementary point to Ira's point, which I thought was really important, which is, you know, Japan, in theory, should be raising rates, but the U.S. needs Japan to make stuff for us to try to reassure, et cetera. And if they strengthen the yen, it's going to make us buy in that more inflationary. It's an inflationary problem for us. Puts upward pressure on inflation, higher 10-year yields problem. And then the same other side, Japan doesn't raise rates to defend the yen. We get our stuff cheaper, but you're going to end up with capital coming back here as JGB yields, or excuse me, capital leaving here, going there as JGB yields rise to address the weak currency. And it really, I look at that, I don't know how it's going to work out, but I know it can't work out well relative to the leverage in the system. And that's another, you know, you sort of layer that on the pile of strike six or strike seven or whatever it is of just reasons to be cautious at the moment. In terms of the stable coin side, I can see what they're trying to do, which is they need a source of repressible balance sheet. They need somebody willing to buy lots of debt at negative real rates. And in theory, stable coins could work. There's been, up till now, including myself, one sort of central area of stable coin demand discussed, which is, you know, we'll have foreigners buy lots of stable coins, basically, which is, hey, Bessent cited the Nigerian Naira. Maybe people in Africa would rather hold dollar stable coins in their own currency. No question. And we've now explicitly tied dollar stable coins to U.S. T-bill markets. Okay. Another one we've heard and we've discussed has been the possibility of weaponizing stable coins, right? Which is to say, hey, the euro dollar is, we don't know exactly how big it is, but it's probably tens of trillions of dollars. There's all these offshore dollar deposits, and we can make some sort of announcement either outright or through back channels that in the next crisis, we will not be offering dollar swap lines to the euro dollar market, but we will offer full faith and credit to anything in dollar stable coins, which will have, you know, T-bill backed, and basically try to siphon capital out of primarily Europe, but also around the world. And in theory, that works, but it is like burning your furniture to stay warm or peeing your pants in a snowstorm to stay warm. It feels good for a second. And, you know, and the reason I say that is, the U.S. net international investment position continues to be ignored in these discussions. And that's just the other side of the balance sheet, which is to say foreigners own $63 trillion gross, $26 trillion net of U.S. dollar denominated assets, including, call it, $8.5 trillion of U.S. treasuries. And so to the extent we could absolutely do one of these things to siphon large amounts of dollars out of the euro dollar market, et cetera, that's going to last for like a few weeks at most until it creates dollar strength, dollar shortages in these places. And we know how these foreigners are going to react. They have $63 trillion gross, $26 trillion net of dollar assets that they can sell to get the dollars they need, which is ultimately going to lead to another one of these Liberation Day type, one of these types of crises we've seen in recent years, which is the dollar gets a bit too strong and then boom, bonds down, stocks down until more liquidity is offered. So those have been kind of the two dynamics we've discussed. Stable coins domestically, I don't see why you use them without having rates get cut to zero. I mean, it makes no sense since they yield zero by law. The last thing that is just literally in the last week or two that has come out, and a guy named Daryl Duffy, who's, I believe he's still a prof at Stanford, but he's a former Treasury official, very much an expert in the Treasury market. He just wrote a piece in the Financial Times, I think 2 days ago, talking about these I think they're called ports, and I forget what they are, but a permanent overnight refunding with treasuries. The gist of it is we are going to try to move our financial markets onto the blockchain and then use this is brand new, so I'm trying to talk through this. You're basically using, you're creating these short-term stable coins backed by overnight treasuries to as settlement mechanisms for the U.S. markets, which is essentially using the U.S. market dominance to create overnight demand for treasuries. And Duffy says in his article, this might eliminate the need to finance, to offer longer term treasuries where our financing problems are. Yes. Could it work? Yes. But let's call this what this is. This is financing 6 to 7% plus fiscal deficits in overnight markets, in near cash equivalents. This is like, you know, if you look at a dollar bill is just a federal, it says Federal Reserve note right on it. A dollar bill is just a 0% yielding note of zero duration. What Duffy is recommending doing is effectively, you know, as the Fed cuts rates in particular, the closer the Fed front end gets to zero, if you move towards what Duffy recommends and issue more and more of these T-bill backed stablecoin overnight funding mechanisms backed by U.S. markets to fund the deficits, you know, number one, it's a flow chart that looks exactly like one of these AI financing charts, right? It is, right. Which is yeah. What it is, except it's for the most powerful country in the world, the reserve currency issuer. But number two, it's the kissing cousin of financing with cash. It's a kissing cousin of what they did in Weimar Germany, which is print money to finance deficits, because you're just talking and, you know, it's an overnight. So it's very little different than cash in terms of its duration. To the extent there's a rate on it, that moves it a little further away from just straight cash printing. But it's not that different. And so it would be extraordinarily inflationary, in my opinion, and it would probably be reflected in the dollar. And it could be sort of a source of massive, massive liquidity. So let's watch and see. That, in theory, that could work. But it's sort of... You know, they're making things a lot more complicated than they need to be, in my opinion. If you're going to do that, you might as well just revalue the gold to 40,000 an ounce, put it in the TGA, buy back the treasury market at a discount, you know, and start over after hitting the reset button rather than trying to create all this. But at any rate, that's neither here nor there. Let's see if this overnight thing backed by markets, cash, you know, financing deficits of cash equivalent stable coins can work. Because if it doesn't, you know, until they get to that point, it's another one of these things that is, yes, on the margin, stable coins can help, but it's you know, it doesn't change my view of anything less than nuclear printing. Nuclear level printing is tightening.
Mm-hmm. And given all of these risks go ahead, Ira. Yeah.
Because this is so important, because I've tried to wrap my head around stable coins. I go, and I was invested, Luke, in a blockchain company called Ninth Gear. They'd put me on their board because they were looking to be in the foreign exchange markets and crush the time from spot deliveries from 2 days down to basically 2 minutes using the blockchain. They have disappeared, but it was interesting, and I learned a lot, but they had come to me seeking some foreign exchange knowledge. So I'm very aware of that blockchain, and I read the article too by Duffy. But I posit this, and I've asked people about this. Why do I need stable coins? When, to me, a stable coin, if I'm using it to pay for things around the world, and it's all electronic. If I'm a bank, a commercial bank, outside, therefore, the Genius Act, I can just tell you, Luke, give me $100,000. I'll give you a debit card and I'll pay you 2.5% on your money on your debit card. And if you get to under such and such a level, I'm going to ask you to refurbish and replenish the account. What do I need a stable coin for? I scratch my head about this. It's, as you rightly, it just complicates things. But as you rightly pose, they're offering this up. And in fact, that it, they see it backed by treasury bills. So it's another way to soak up the demand. Remember that these two, Marin and Bessent, and again, I speak of, I have a lot of respect, or I've had a lot of respect for Bessent over the years, many, many years. But when I see this, they were coming in and they were going to undo everything that Brainard and Yellen did, right? With they were railing against them the way that they were issuing so many T-bills, especially coming into the election because they didn't want the bonds. And we saw that with the pressure they were putting on Kuroda at the BOJ. So they didn't want pressure on the bond market and they were front loading them. But they've taken it now up exponentially. And I thought that Bessent, had he had any testicles to speak of, that he would have come in and pushed for a failed auction. Again, just to slap everybody in the heads, because everybody in Congress, there's no partisanship in this. This is a bipartisan. It's the only thing they agree on is spending money, and the numbers are vast. And we are at the point, and I don't care what Powell says or anybody else, and nobody who sits in those damn press conferences dare ask the question, but are we not in a period of fiscal dominance? And I'll cite the paper written by the Fed's own Charles Calamaris out of the St. Louis Fed, because we are in fiscal dominance. When it explodes, absolutely. I don't know, but I'll leave you. I'll let you discuss that.
No, it's a great point because, you know, to me, he is same thing. I know him to be brilliant. You know, I've met him before. In meetings hosted by a friend of mine, a mutual friend of ours. And he's obviously very savvy in markets. And so to me, you know, I totally agree with your point. I think, A, he missed a huge opportunity, which is, you know, it's kind of like new managements at a company. When you come into a bad situation in a company as the new management, the smartest thing you can do is clear the decks, take a big bath, and point it all at the last management. And so they had a window to do that, and I think that window's closed now. And what I don't know, but I can presume, because I know Bessent to be very smart, very savvy. So when I see somebody I know to be very smart and very savvy doing unsmart and unsavvy things, there's only a couple reasons for that, and. To me, it's primarily politics or other things that are sort of above his pay grade in the seat he's now in. Like the fact that he didn't take the big bath and whether that was a failed auction, as you pointed out, or just something that gave him the operating room to do what he needed to do rather than basically double down on what Yellen et al. Were doing, suggest to me he got sat down after he was sworn in and he got read in and realized, oh my God, this is so much worse than I knew. That's the only thing that makes sense to me. And or that, look, if you do this, there is this agreement that's on the books with fill in the blank, or the Chinese will respond this way or this, or the gold market will do this and we have to get these people on sides first, or we have to repatriate the gold first before we try this. There's a whole number of different things that I don't know the other side of it. But sort of, you know, you went in the same way that you can measure the size of a shark from the fin to the tail, if they're both above the water, roughly how long the shark is, you can measure like what is going on under the water in terms of how hard Bessent's paddling by the actions he has done above the surface. And, you know, I don't know what I don't know, but I know enough to say, you know, given strike, you know, 1 through 7 we ran through before, I don't need to have my capital at risk here right now. I just, you know, I'll fold and I will sit in cash and I'll wait for another hand.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Coming to a time constraint here. If you can provide your final thoughts, what to do with your capital in this environment, IRA. Yeah.
Well, I'm just, you know, everything that Luke talks about, I don't even have to read the forest from the trees. I mean, this is so right on target. And again, what does it come back to? Government debt. And the fact that it's so out of control, and you can paper and paste over it all you want, but that just means, you know, it's like when you try to sit on, a balloon and the air go, it's just going to move somewhere else, and it's moving. And we saw the movement when it, because again, the global system is so leveraged up. And the scare is that a currency that they should be using for the carry trade, they're not even bothered. They're using that as a safety valve that pays zero because they're so nervous outside of just precious metals. And I'm not even putting Bitcoin or any crypto in there, but just, and I'm with Luke. If we're right, the yield curves are going to steepen dramatically until they force a calling of the question. They have to. And they're trying, and that's even with people, because, you know, as there was the article yesterday on Bloomberg by Alexandra Harris talking about money funds are now over $8 trillion. With everything that was supposed to be going on, they weren't supposed to be growing through this. So again, there's more signs, you know, wherever we're sitting here, and of course, we're coming into year end. So a lot of fund managers are going to be trying to protect their year end profits, as they always do, or to try to dress up their, some of their investment. And again, markets start to thin out. But what we also saw, Luke, that discussion about that there's fear about some of the basis traders in the debt markets, right? Because they've grown so big in order to take on these arbitrage trades. But there's a lot of leverage applied there. So there are some very dangerous things building here. When is it going to happen? I'm with Luke. I don't know, but I sure look and watch. And that's why the previous period of time was so interesting. But as you're asking, are there still good investments? Yeah, I'm still, I think commodities, as others are talking about, from Doomberg to certainly Adam Rosenzweig and Goering, I think those are some very interesting places to be. And therefore, I'm watching some of the commodity currencies. So one of the main areas for me, and I'm just watching it because I don't have I don't have anywhere near to define, and I'm a risk definer before I take on any trade, but I'm watching the CAD Swiss, because if the Swiss really start to move to weaken the currency, will they be buying assets in places like Canada, Australia, New Zealand's got issues, but some of the commodity currencies, have been really performing well. And again, emerging markets have been, really been performing well. You got the peso at levels that are more of an interest. The real, which started the week a week over some grain issues, some grain exports that the Chinese said they didn't want because of contamination. So there was, but the real, dollar real is back to 5.30, 5.0. So there are things going on. These are where I'm going. I still love, and I still love Commerce Bank and Mitsubishi Tokyo as my banker, along with UBS. And I'm still, I think those are solid plays going forward. Yep. But that's
great.
It.
Yeah. Thanks, Aaron. And just last second thought, your thoughts, Luke, last comments.
I think ultimately it's, around, before print and after print type of thoughts. I think one of the few things that does well, no matter in all three of those scenarios, is gold and sort of very short term U.S. paper, I think will be fine. As I look out even more secularly, I continue to like U.S. electrical infrastructure related industrials. The Japanese multinational industrials, Mitsubishi, Hitachi in particular, they've had very good runs. They've pulled back a little bit off the highs last I checked. But I think, once you look out away from whatever sort of, I think, kind of whoosh down we're moving towards, they make a lot of sense because every sign from the U.S. is that we have neither, we do not have the ability to reshore and rebuild our grid without a lot of help from overseas. And that means, practically speaking, given what's happening in Europe with their industrial base and energy supply chain, it's Japan, South Korea, or China. And so I think Japan, it's not going to be China. So I think Japanese multinational industrials, I think South Korean as well, would probably do well there too.
Great. Thanks very much, Luke. And yeah, that's what we can do today, but we'll continue the discussion another time if that's okay. Want to thank very much, Luke, Ira. Thank you very much.
Thanks for having me on. Hey, have a great rest of your day. Bye bye.
It's great. Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk.